Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's November the 9th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Every 6 months or so, I send out a series of 56 email articles to those who request it, entitled The Weird Aryan History Series, which, so far as I can tell, very few people actually bother to read. And why they request it, if they're not going to read it, I have no idea, but we won't get into that. In order to announce the latest transmission of the Weird Aryan History Series of articles, I send out the following email. Someone once said that Americans are a people without a past. I once saw a statistic to the effect that less than 50% of Americans, meaning white Americans, can name all four of their grandparents. I mean actually name them. Grandpa and Meemaw don't count. And less than 10% could name more than one great-grandparent. Many Americans confuse the Korean War with World War II. Something like 30% of the reporters in the Gulf War did not know that there had been a World War I, although you'd think the designation of World War II might have tipped them off that there was a previous version floating around somewhere. That's a true story. We as a people have no idea of where we've been, so it's no wonder that we have no idea where we're going. Now, my Weird Aryan History series is an attempt to remedy that. To inform white nationalists of some of the more interesting events in the history of our people, and let them know that, yes, in fact, there were Aryan events going on before the time of the cowboys and the Indians, which is as far back as most Americans have any historical awareness at all. Beyond a highly inaccurate movie version of the Wild West, some Americans have a vague impression of the Civil War. Of course, some reenactors are downright anal about the 1861-1865 period, to the exclusion of the other 3,000-odd years of Western civilization, just like some National Socialists can recite a day-by-day history of the Third Reich from 1933 to 1945 and nothing else at all. There is a dimmer impression in a few consciousnesses of George Washington crossing the Delaware and guys in white wigs signing something in 1776, and beyond that, there's Elmer Fudd in Puritan dress wearing a cartoon steeple crown hat and carrying a blunderbuss hunting turkeys for Thanksgiving. And by the way, nobody in the 17th or 18th centuries hunted with a blunderbuss. For 99% of Americans, that's it. That's all they know about their own history. Okay, I won't read the rest of that email, but you get the idea. Now this week, thanks to a young comrade who pointed this out to me, I'm going to be able to present to you folks a little white history from an even older time than the 1920s and 1930s, you know, the speeches from Huey Long and Father Coughlin I've been playing. I'm going to be able to take you in audio back to the one time in our history when the white man rose up in arms against the tyrant in Washington, D.C. Now, it's not generally realized, but there were veterans of the American Civil War, especially Confederate veterans, who lived to be very old men, and who survived into the age of sound recording, and who were therefore able to leave at least some verbal account of the struggle for white freedom from tyranny that took place between 1861 and 1865. Now, I admit, I have pinched and edited the following presentation shamelessly off YouTube. I won't name the historians and the Confederate reenactors involved, since I think it's a safe bet that, like most of their kind, they would recoil in horror at the idea of any involvement beyond the groves of academe, any contact with the real thing. But the history and the heritage that they speak of belongs not just to their little circle of hobbyists, it belongs to the entire folk.
The very essence of the Museum of the Confederacy is to be an educational institution. We've got this fabulous collection. If we use it properly, people will understand more the people of the South and the conduct of the war. If you listen to the CD that we put together, we explained the history of the yell, the size of different units, and the sound, the rebel yell, the mystery of it. The fact that historians for decades have said the sound has been lost. We don't know what it sounded like. The fact that reenactors and Confederate veterans heritage groups have been giving what they thought was the rebel yell. To determine what it really sounded like was an adventure. And it was one of the most important sounds of the war. Shortly after I took the job, I went down to a Civil War Preservation Trust meeting, and I was riding in a bus on a battlefield tour with someone who told me about one of the original recordings of the rebel yell. And I came back from that trip and went on the website and listened to it. And I said, wow, that doesn't sound like what I thought it was supposed to sound like. And that piqued my imagination. I guess it was an epiphany when we said, gee, it was not one guy doing it. It was not one soldier by himself that was being described. It was tens or hundreds or thousands at a time giving the yell. And that really started us on the project of, let's give this one person multiple voices. Enter the world of new technology. And it was not complicated technology or anything. It was just, I'd go to a sound studio and get that one voice recorded over and over on top of itself. We altered the treble each time. We altered the speed, the tenor, so that it sounded like 100 or 1,000 different guys. When that came back from the sound studio and we put it on a CD player, what a thrill. Because it didn't sound at all like the one guy, and it sounded remarkably like the words in the letters and memoirs were describing. You could sense the adrenaline rush that the Confederate soldiers would get when they were giving it. You could sense the chest would fill up, and you didn't care that grape and canister was coming your way and men were falling left and right. The flip side of that is you could sense the eeriness, the spookiness, the fear that would have gone into the Union troops. After we listened to it and reflected on it, the one voice multiplied into thousands, then came a period of distrust. Could this person be representative of the whole Confederate Army? At that time, we said, we need to find another recording. Did all the normal searches on the internet and finally saw some reference to the fact that the United Daughters of the Confederacy had a copy of a rebel yell given by a Confederate veteran. And I recall vividly putting that CD on the CD player. And I hit the play button. And here that exact same sound came pouring out of the speakers. And I remember the flush of saying, we've got it. Here are two different men, two different units, two different times, one being recorded in North Carolina, the other in California, one infantry, the other cavalry, one North Carolina, the other Virginia. This was enough credible evidence that these two guys doing the same sound were representative of the Confederate Army. And so the project really took off from there. The question of the rebel yell has been revived in part, I think, by this discovery that we've made in the CD we produced. Clearly, there's still untold stories that the one thing that we did not find was, what's the origin? Where did it come from? I think that more research could lead us to a better understanding of the origin of the rebel yell. That would be the one piece that I would love to see clarified over the next couple of decades.
The yell was different from all the sounds ever heard. the throats of maddened hounds, of starved hyenas and angry beasts, in deadly fight over bloody feasts, or wails of souls in purgatory. Lost to heaven and all its glory, ne'er cast over man such awful spells of terror as did those rebel yells.
After 22 years of reenacting, I discovered something. When we have been doing the rebel yell for all those 22 years prior to learning the proper rebel yell, we would go on the field and we would give a yell. And it would expel all the air out of our lungs because we yelled at the top of our voice because we wanted to make it sound as loud as humanly possible and to put fear in the people in front of us. But what that did, it really wore us out. Because as you're marching across the field and you yell at the top of your voice and all the air goes out your lungs, you're gasping for more air. But when you do the rebel yell the proper way with a cadence to it, the high-pitched yelp, the low-pitched bark, and a long high-pitched yelp. It's much like talking, and you don't run out of air, and you don't get exhausted, and you can do this marching across an entire field without getting exhausted. And when the Museum of the Confederacy put together their CD, The Rebel Yell Lives, they took these two voices, and they blended them together, and they made some high-pitched, some lower-pitched, so it sounded like a lot more men than just two men. And they put that all together so you would hear what a regiment and a brigade and a division sounded like and an entire army. But what they did was true to life. Because when you hear men do it in reality and you hear 40 men or 400 men, it sounds exactly like what the Museum of the Confederacy put out. And I have to take my hat off to them. They did a wonderful job. After I heard the CD for the first time, I knew that this had to be taught to as many Confederate reenactors as possible. I went out to my reenactment unit when we had our School of the Soldier, and I taught it to them. And I filmed the 40 of us doing it on the field that day, pitched the idea then to the museum about coming out and filming this themselves to a larger unit. So we did it last year at Cedar Creek with 400 reenactors there.
But there's one thing throughout the years that we have been doing incorrect, and that is the rebel yell. And so that is why I'm here today, so to teach you the proper rebel yell. It is in a cadence of three. A high-pitched yelp, a low-pitched bark, and then a long high-pitched yelp. It goes, help! Oh! Oh! Help! Oh, help! So, here is your chance. Give me a high pitch yelp. Help! Help! Now give me a low pitch bark. Now give me a long high pitch yelp. Help!
First, when we were up at Cedar Creek and I taught the 400 of them the proper way to do the rebel yell, we assembled ourselves to do a charge, a bayonet charge across the field. And I mean, it was the talk all around camp after that charge. I mean, everybody was enthusiastic about it because for us to be able to not only know what it sounded like, to be able to recreate it ourselves, it reached something inside all of us that we were very proud to be part of bringing this history back to life.
You know, all you human slugs from the FBI and the DHS who are listening to this, now make sure you listen to that sound good. Because one day you're going to hear it again when the white man changes his thinking and recovers his ancient courage. One day, you're going to hear us again coming for you and your bosses in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Well, this is me and Sally and Wallace, and we're just sort of sitting here, hanging around the office, hovering in front of the microphone, and we're just going to talk about whatever comes to our mind. The first topic that came up, I did get a letter from Edgar Steele. It is the second letter that I've gotten from him since he went to prison in June of 2010. This was in response to a postcard that I sent him and a letter as well saying, "Hey, Ed, are you getting the mail that I'm sending you? The Northwest Observers and the letters and the books and this sort of stuff." And apparently he's not getting most of it. So the general response, where's the letter? I'm going to read this real quick. "Dear Harold, thanks for the note and for thinking of me. I recall one letter from you while I was in Bonner 5 months ago, and another in Spokane about a year ago. Pretty sure that's it, though you were kind enough to send $100 for my account and one of your quite good books, too, at the same address." Oh, so he did get one of the novels. "I know that I've written a couple of times a note of thanks and request for your newsletter, which I have gotten 3 or 4 times, thanks. Lots of my mail disappears. Lots. I like to think that the feds take it home to sell on eBay after I become famous for actually beating them at retrial. Thanks for all the support, Harold. Edgar Steele." So he's keeping his spirits up.
You were saying he was going to be sentenced to 60 years?
That is what they're asking for. I find it difficult to believe that even these sons of bitches would seriously impose a 60-year sentence on a 66-year-old man, but there is no end to the depth of depravity these people are capable of.
Well, they've proven that time and time again already with situations like Waco and the things that they're doing all around the world right now. It's really not surprising when you think about it. You know, if they'll murder children in Waco and Randy Weaver's family in Ruby Ridge, it's not surprising at all that they'll put an old man in jail on forged tapes of him, you know, to carry out a plot that he never even did.
Well, it's one of two things. Either it's an experiment in order to see if they can get away with actually forging audio tapes and fabricating evidence from the ground up, in which case this is a very sinister precedent indeed, because it means that they can literally come along and lock up anybody that they want for anything. All they have to do is fabricate a bunch of audio to the effect that you're overheard hiring a hitman to kill the Dalai Lama or whatever. Either that, or he just plain pissed somebody off. There's always been a level of personal malice in this that has been very apparent to me. Somebody, I think, just at some point made the decision they're going to get Ed Steele, period, end of story.
Well, it kind of makes me wonder why they don't all just burst in the door any minute and take all three of us.
That thought has occurred to me. I mean, they could. At some point in time, we are going to appear on their radar with sufficient clarity and sufficient urgency that they will probably do something, and I think anyone who resists this system has to accept this in their own mind. It helps that we don't actually do anything illegal, but then again, Ed Steele didn't either. I'm sure they've got enough audio of me on Radio Free Northwest, and now you two as well, that if they want to, they can have us conspiring together to blow up Santa Claus at the North Pole or something. It's just... This is why I did the Brandenburg lectures. I wanted to basically go ahead and give them their shot. If they're going to come and lock me up, essentially for being Harold Covington, for being who I am, at least let them prefer the real charges. Don't make up some stupid crap about molesting llamas in the zoo or so, whatever. Some of the things that they've made up, like James Wickstrom was lured into a situation where he ended up in a motel room with paper bags full of counterfeit money. This was a very elaborate sting that the FBI set up, and it was obviously something that took them quite a while to figure out and quite a while to get into motion, and they're capable of elaborate stings like that, but, you know, why bother? I mean, let's face it. The real charge against me, if and when they ever drag me up in front of one of these political gangsters in a black robe, will be that I am who I am, I think what I think, and I say what I say.
Okay, well, just for the record, if there ever happens to be produced an audio wherein I hire someone to kill you, I think you know it didn't happen.
You don't have any money.
And that's another thing, too. One of the most disturbing things about the Ed Steele case is just how much common individuals don't know about it. Apart from Radio Free Northwest and the Free Edgar Steele website, nobody's even allowed to know about these things, and that's part of the unpleasant truths of our society, is that our enemies have complete control over what other individuals can and can't know.
You could probably hire Dry Ice to kill me. I think he'd do it for a bottle of Thunderbird.
That's good to know.
I believe I read an email from the Youth for Western Civilization, another, I guess it's a right-wing movement that's going across college campuses. They sent out an email about how a lot of lefties are trying to criticize certain Halloween costumes, trying to say they're racist or ridiculous and things like that. I don't recall all of the details, but it's basically just another one of these attempts for these people to try and control other people's lives, and that's just another manifestation of it. And they've been attacking Christmas and Easter for so long now, it only makes sense that they'll go to Halloween, which is another traditional European holiday that has folk root traditions, and it only makes sense that these people would want to have complete control over that as well.
My own children actually were not allowed to wear Halloween costumes to school, and I asked them why, and they said it was because of the children who don't celebrate Halloween, that it might make them uncomfortable. And I think, again, Wallace is right when he says this is just an attempt at taking a stab at a white holiday. The schools would never get away with telling some other race or culture that they could not celebrate their cultural tradition in a public school.
Well, niggers get to celebrate Kwanzaa in school, no doubt, and that isn't even a holiday. I mean, there is no such thing in Africa as Kwanzaa. I know because I've lived in Africa.
And speaking of niggers on Halloween, I think they use the holiday as just another excuse to engage in their typical nigger behavior. Just being out trick-or-treating, I would see the white kids with their parents dressed up in little costumes, knocking on doors, saying trick-or-treat and thank you. And the nigger kids, they'd be walking around with no parents, no costumes, just an old sack for candy, knocking on the door, and just standing there, not saying anything.
Trick-or-treat, motherfucker!
Not even that.
Give candy, motherfucker. I bust a cap on your ass.
And then, of course, they'd also kick other people's cars and doors and throw things and just, you know, the way they do wherever they go on any day.
In a weird kind of way, I can kind of understand that kind of behavior on their part because, let's face it, these creatures are inferior. They're mentally below our level, but they do have enough cognizant ability, I guess you'd call it, to realize the fact that they are trapped in this superior civilization that they can never be a part of. Many years ago, back in the 60s, like we were talking about last week, I read some article by some nigger, and he was being interviewed by some white journalist, blah, blah. Well, what do black people really want? And this nigger was surprisingly honest. And he said, look, what we really want is to be white. But we can't have that. We can't ever be white. And so, as a result, we're going to tear up everything you've got. And that was basically the gist of it. And I can understand that reaction. In a way, it's almost pathetic. These poor little niggers can never be part of this wonderful world that they see all around them. They know that they can't because they know that it's a white folks thing. They know they can never be really integrated, and they know that we will never really in our hearts accept them. And so naturally, they lash out and act out and that sort of stuff. This doesn't excuse it. I still think they all need to be rounded up and shot and buried in pits and whatnot, but still, it's understandable.
Well, I also noticed they tend to destroy everything they've got, too. They hurt their own children, their own neighborhoods, their own property as a way to get back at Whitey.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting that niggers and the great apes, like the gorillas and the orangutans, are the only known animals in nature that will foul their own nest. Every other animal, when he has to do his business or whatever, he goes out in the woods, like a cat, if you've ever seen one before you stomped on it, cat will actually, you know, use a litter box, or in the wild, they'll scrape a hole, they'll do the business, and then they'll bury it so that other animals can't get their scent. No other animal will foul its own nest and destroy its own habitat, except for the great primates and niggers.
I just remember seeing old footage of Nazi protest riots where the niggers, they would just start trashing their own neighborhoods, their own stores. I remember seeing a clip of a group of them as kind of a last resort. They started beating up a fence.
Yeah, well, I was talking earlier about you two guys are make me feel real old because...
Because you are.
Well, I am, yes, but you guys don't even remember who Long Dong Silver was. I mean, it's your education has been sadly neglected. But anyway, in the 60s, in the riots, it was noticed even at the time when the niggers rioted, they burned down their own areas. And same thing happened in Los Angeles in 92 when the two white cops were, or the four white cops, I'm sorry, were acquitted over whooping up on Rodney King. For all of the publicity about it, most of the rioting was in the black areas. And same damn thing happened with these London riots over the summer when the niggers were rioting in London and, you know, burning down whatnot. They were mostly in places like Notting Hill and Brixton in the blacker areas of London. Unfortunately, there was a white Whigger element involved in that as well. But what they were doing is they weren't actually revolting against the system or anything like that. They were burning down stores and looting. Basically stealing whatever they could. It wasn't even really a riot. It was just a mass stealing spree. So niggers are intelligent, but it's a primitive kind of intelligence. They can never actually compete against or in any way replace whites. And this is what puzzles me. I just wonder, all these smart liberals and these Jews and whatnot, when they eventually do succeed in exterminating the white man, what do they think is going to take our place?
I think like most Americans, they don't really think that far ahead. Could be a few different things, really. The most likely is they just don't think that far ahead. Their simmering hatred for the white race just takes precedent over everything. You also have to remember we live in a time where truth isn't very valuable. I really believe they probably have just rationalized in their own minds that after we're gone, they're just going to live in some multicultural paradise where there's no evil, oppressive white man to bring them all down and do them down and commit holocausts and enforce slavery and all that kind of crap. And they just think everything will be good and wonderful and their whole little new world order and this type of bliss that they created. And once again, of course, this is all just a pipe dream. It has nothing to do with anything real. But the truth of the matter is, they're not going to eliminate the white race, because we at the Northwest Front aren't going to let that happen, are we?
Tell it all, brother! Tell it! Testify, brother! Testify! Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, back to the kids at school not being allowed to wear their costumes anymore. I still remember when I was that age, if there was one kid in the classroom who was different, he didn't get to dictate the way the rest of the school got to do anything. The stupid little Jewish kid got to sit in the back of the classroom on Christmas and look at our Santa Clauses and our Christmas trees and just cry about the Holocaust or something. He didn't get to tell everyone else in the whole school that we don't get to celebrate Christmas anymore. And then I remember around junior high age, something with these rules about bringing food to class started to change. We had to accommodate everyone's stupid vegan diets and stupid kosher diets and stupid food allergies just because these kids are freaks who can't digest foods properly or who have stupid religious customs where they don't eat like the rest of the world. Now everyone else has to accommodate them. When did things change so that the people who were different got to make all the rules?
When liberalism officially transmuted into political correctness, for one thing, but mostly it's when the goddamn lawyers took over. You know, we as a nation have got, a population of 300 million, and about 2 million of them are lawyers, and I'm not making that up. Apparently that's about the statistic. A lot of the politically correct crap that goes on in society today, I'm sure some of these administrators and teachers and whatnot know it's ridiculous, but what it is everybody is shit scared of lawyers and lawsuits and litigation. They're scared that if they offend somebody, that somebody's going to be able to pay $200 an hour for an attorney, and then it's the next 3, 4, 5 years in court going back and forth and back and forth, and both sides end up spending $1 million for nothing. So that's one thing I think you got to kind of bear in mind. A lot of the bullshit that goes on in our society today is based on fear of lawyers and fear of litigation.
One of the worst things of our society today, and you've mentioned this before, Harold, is that people's fear to even name the problem. They're afraid to even talk about these issues, and they get very frightened or uncomfortable when anyone else brings it up. And that's, I would even say, problem number one right there, because if you can't even bring it in yourself to address the issue, then, you know, you've already let yourself be defeated. You're only defeated when your mind is under control, and that's why Orwell's 1984 is such a sobering story, is because the way that the party in 1984 gets control of everyone is it controls the way they think. I've heard several discussions with relatives in which they've implied, well, things aren't good right now because our people are kind of moving away away, and, you know, things are getting worse as they move out and other people move in. I mean, the niggers and spicks are coming in and fucking everything up. They can't just say it overtly like that. Also, I've had conversations with relatives where they say, you know, become a lawyer because they're the only ones that can get any type of power and influence in this society right now. Just tell me a plain as day fact. You can openly admit this and then you don't want to do anything about it? I mean, what the hell is wrong with people?
Well, as I pointed out, our draft constitution for the Northwest American Republic forbids anyone to accept anything of value, money, or any kind of remuneration for acting as an advocate in a legal case. There are certain classes of people who need to be removed from society. The Bolsheviks got that one right, at least. And one of those classes of people is lawyers. I wrote a long essay called The Law is an Ass. It's on Thought Crime Blog if you guys want to read it. The state of the criminal law and the civil law in this country is disgraced. That is the basis of a lot that is wrong in this society, because anybody who can hire one of these 2 million damn ambulance-chasing lawyers that's running around can screw up somebody's life for years and maybe permanently destroy them by bankrupting them. And in a way, it's almost worse than fear of mad gunfighters or Mad Max savages and blue mohawks, because in our own 21st century way, lawyers are the people that actually have the power, you're right, that they can actually destroy you. This is why most Americans, I think they shit in their pants at the sight of a legal letterhead. This is one of the things I found out when I was dealing with that situation I had about 15 years ago. Of course, you know, there is a way that we can put an end to all this. This is the Dubliners.
And come tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together at the rising of the moon. And come tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, at the old spot by the river, quite well known to you and me. One more word for signal token, whistle out the marching tune, with your pike upon your shoulder, at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, at the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud-walled cabin, eyes were watching through the night. Many a man, the heart was beating for the blessed morning light. Murmurs rang along the valley to the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand pikes were flashing by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, and a thousand lights were flashing by the rising of the moon. All along that singing river, that black mass of men was seen. High above their shining weapons flew their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, whistle out the marching tune, and hurrah, me boys, for freedom. 'Tis the rising of the moon, 'tis the rising of the moon, 'tis the rising of the moon, and hurrah, me boys, for freedom. 'Tis the rising of the moon. We are its living mother.
guys, this is Axis Sally, and I just want to pass on a short tip to all you activist types out there. One of the main symptoms of this society's disease is the proliferation of weak, arrogant, incompetent, and silly people in positions of petty power over people's lives. Bureaucrats, supervisors, teachers, thugs from the badly misnamed Child Protective Services agencies, attorneys, judges, administrators of various kinds, the 101 little commissars of political correctness that white males and increasingly white females as well have to put up with in their day-to-day existence. Most white people probably don't bear any kind of personal grudge against, say, President Obama or Nancy Pelosi or Jesse Jackson, just a generalized and impersonal resentment. These are celebrity figures, far above their personal orbits, and in most minds there's a disconnect. Obongo isn't really a real person, he's just someone you see on TV, if you get my meaning. But the asshole supervisor at work, the stupid nigger clerk at the grocery store, Apu in the turban behind the counter at the DMV, the Mexicans who visibly take white people's jobs, the ex's vicious attorney, and the judge who never listens, this puts a human face on the evil. Use this in your grassroots work. Let white people know that our victory means all those monkeys off their backs and punished for what they've done. Always try to slip that in. Personal revenge is going to be a major motive in our initial recruiting. It's humanly understandable, and it's a perfectly acceptable motive at first. Use personal wrongs as a hook to get people in and get them in a frame of mind so they'll listen to the ideological stuff and educate them from there so they'll know why all this has happened. When it's time for me to think of a new topic for Radio Free Northwest, I find it easiest to start thinking of things I find really stupid. I've already talked about young, tattooed, video game-playing subhuman scum, prisons and their lame rules about getting mail from us, and, of course, cats. And some other stupid things came to mind. Hippies. Men who cry. And then, of course, Stormfront. My feelings on white internet forums aren't exactly a secret, so there's no reason to get into all that again. But what especially gets me about Stormfront is their ban on the N-word. Harold was talking about this last week, which reminded me of the cutest thing I'd ever heard from my own kids, the two of them saying, in unison sing-song, "Nigger faggot." Never mind where they learned that word. I had my reasons for them not wanting to repeat it. For starters, not every adult who is involved in their lives feels the same way I do about certain matters, and while I'm not exactly happy with the fact that they're in public school, that arrangement may be a lasting one, and I really don't want them targeted and tracked and put on Ritalin or whatever else they decide to give kids who voice intolerant and racist thoughts. So I explained to them, nigger and faggot are names to call people, and we don't call names. I prefer to take the stance that name-calling is not a dignified behavior for little white girls, rather than that nigger is such a horrible, horrible word, the worst word in the whole world. Which is what I don't get about Stormfront. You're not allowed to say nigger, but you can say mud, darky, groid, nignog, and nogger. Harold likes to say munkoid, and I'm sure that would fly too. And for some reason, you're allowed to say faggot, spick, beaner, dyke, kike, and heeb. So, for some reason, you're allowed to use pretty much any racial epithet except for nigger. It makes no sense at all. I would be upset to hear that one of my daughters had called someone a nigger, but I would be equally upset to hear they had called someone a bitch or anything else. Name-calling is not an appropriate behavior for a white child, regardless of the name used. So, it would make more sense if Stormfront would adopt an all-or-nothing policy regarding profanity and epithets. Either ban them all or allow them all. Niggers don't deserve any special consideration from white nationalist websites when the kikes and the faggots don't get it. I'm about to do something out of character here, and that is actually respond to dumb retards on the internet who infer that I must be either a Jew or a nigger or even a man because I won't send them pictures. Yeah, that's not my picture on my Facebook profile. I thought everyone was aware of that. When I set up the page, I googled Axis Sally and I chose the first thing that came up. This all came up recently. I've always been involved in some kind of a strength training regimen because we're at war here and I may have to carry one of you to safety, and most likely you'll be weighed down by all your Xboxes and plasma TVs and a bunch of other stuff that keeps you from crying yourself to sleep at night over the fact that you've never accomplished anything for our race and our utter failures. So I need to be strong enough to lift all that stuff. And one day I managed a particularly heavy lift that surprised me and I posted that on the Facebook page. Someone made a comment asking how I could possibly lift that much given how small I appeared in my profile picture. And I responded that, yes, I am small, but I still lifted it, and that's not even my real picture anyway. And then the messages started. Well, send me a pic then. Or come meet me. Prove you're not some nigger or some 50-year-old dude or an ugly chick. That will never happen. I don't care if you live close to me. I don't do personal meetings to satisfy people's curiosity about who the hell I really am. If you're interested in the Northwest Front, go through the proper steps to meet Harold and start coming to his gatherings or helping us out around the Northwest Publishing Agency, and you'll run into me. I'll be the pissed-off-looking one who probably won't talk to you because you were largely uninteresting to me. And the reason I don't post pictures is because of something that one particular dumb skinhead type felt the need to make public. I've been involved with the family courts for some time now due to my beliefs and my presence on this program. Once this white power retard found out the true identity of Axis Sally, he pranced around his little town squealing, "I know who she is," and made sure that white children suffered as a result. Thankfully, that situation eventually was taken care of after the skinhead's drug use and illiteracy were revealed. But I believe it is a mistake for anyone involved in a child custody dispute to post a picture of themselves or their children on any racialist website, which is why I also took down the pictures of my kids. So, as to my profile pic, the fake one is here to stay. This also means, unfortunately, that our studio isn't quite as nice as the one in the picture. And as far as my real identity, there are only a few important things you need to know. I am white, I am female, I was born in 1979, I'm a little tiny person who can push some heavy weight, and I'm a hell of a lot better looking than that picture I found.
Now, I know I'm probably going to get some adverse emails about that one, telling me all about how Sally is being mean and nasty again, and I need to cast her into outer darkness, or at least lock her in the basement with no supper, etc., etc., so let me deal with that now. There is a small minority of our listeners out there, by which I mean maybe 5 or 6 out of the 4,500 or so who listen to this show every week, who, much as I hate to sound like some left-wing feminist, apparently really do have some problems with a woman being strong and outspoken, period. I've never denied that there is at least a small element of genuine misogyny within the movement, based on the terrible experiences some of our guys have had with the women in their lives and with their attorneys. And sometimes they react by developing a problem with all women, period, instead of just the one woman and the one lawyer that screwed them over. So, let me deal with that. Yes, Sally has some strong opinions. She has reason to. Nor is she always diplomatic in expressing them, and frankly, I find that refreshing. In a world full of bullshit, I have a lot of time for full and open honesty of any kind from anyone. I'm not going to get into her personal history, but just suffice it to say that she's been with the movement for a few years now. She's had a number of typical movement experiences, which have been aggravated by the fact of her being an attractive young woman. Well, young by my standards, anyway. And she's speaking from experience. As am I when I speak of the one issue which is going to make or break us, and which we have adamantly refused to discuss in any serious way for the past 50 years. And that is the issue of our own character. That's what's holding us back. Not the Jews, not Obama, not the FBI, not the niggers or illegal aliens. We are our own worst enemy. And we see that enemy in the mirror every morning. I'm reminded of one of the most famous lines in all of Hollywood cinema from the greatest monkey movie of all time, and no, I don't mean King Kong.
Why me, Lord? You made other men out of clay. Mine, you made out of shit.
For many years, we have had the first taboo firmly in place. We can moan and groan about character issues in general, since after half a century, the problem is so overwhelming that it's now pointless to pretend it doesn't exist. But we must never actually name names or discuss specific incidents. All those many, many, many incidents down through the years where horrible, inexcusable things have been done by those who claim to believe as we do, and those who claim to represent our worldview in public. Now, the problem is, we've tried being nice about all this for the past 50 years, and it hasn't worked. Got a hot flash for you, folks. Nice guys finish last, and when you refuse to talk about a problem, guess what? The problem does not go away. Now we're approaching the kind of situation in America which we right-wingers and racial nationalists claim that we've been awaiting for all these years. You know, all those decades when we claimed we were waiting for the balloon to go up? Well, the balloon is starting to ease upwards, finally. There are millions of white people living in Obamavilles and under bridges because their houses were foreclosed on. There is a whole generation of white males, i.e. mine, who, once they lose their jobs, will never work again in their 40s and 50s. Our race is dying out, as middle class and yuppie couples have spent the past half century having only one child. We are on the verge of a genuine revolutionary window of opportunity, which we're going to miss because we're still screwing around on the internet posting to bulletin boards and blogs. We are almost out of time, and we're still wasting it. You want to know why I don't shut Sally up or cast her into outer darkness or whatever it is that a small handful of you guys want me to do exactly? It's because I'm out of patience with the white man, and I'm frankly glad to have met someone who is just as fed up as I am and who isn't afraid to say so. So now you know that I'm not the only one who has had it up to here with all this bullshit from our so-called comrades who are weak, timid, frightened, incompetent, confused, and so dysfunctional they couldn't organize a piss-up in a brewery. People, we have to stop playing with our computers like we were in junior high school, and we have to get our act together. Now! Somewhat on the same subject, I received another critical audio file this week from one of our listeners, which indicates to me that it's once again time to go over one of those spaced repetition things I have to revisit periodically. Now, I don't mind this, because like I've said before, on this program and throughout the NF's whole propaganda effort, there are some questions that are going to be asked and issues that will be brought up again and again and again by people who have not been able to listen to the almost 100 Radio Free Northwests that have gone before this one, and who therefore honestly believe that they are the first ones to raise whatever the question or objection is. Now, this means that every few podcasts, I go over, once again, a lot of the ground I've already gone over on previous occasions. But that's no problem. Now, those of you who have heard my N-word rap before, just sit back and give it another listen.
Hello, Harold, and victory to the cause. I recall you recently saying that the use of the word nigger was an act which, should you ever lose the courage to use, would indicate that the time had arrived for you to retire. I agree that some words are useful among the initiated, but I want to discuss the tactical and practical reasons why I never use certain words in mixed or otherwise compromised company. It's been said that propaganda is useful in only two kinds of societies, sick ones in need of health, and healthy ones in need of sickness. It's important to remember that any time you use a politically incorrect word, you are agreeing to take on the star quarterback of the propaganda machine. You are single-handedly rising to the challenge of attempting to dispel billions of media and governmental propaganda dollars. When you use trigger words that have been deliberately entrenched in the minds of millions as racist, you are willingly submitting to a game of conviction in which the odds have already been stacked against you. Most of the sheeple's minds simply turn off as they are conditioned to when certain words are used, and the word nigger just happens to be one of them. You may make as much sense and use as many facts as you like, but if you close the mind of your mark, you might as well have never played the game. Courage is one thing, but winning the hearts and minds of others programmed to be hostile to you is quite another matter. Harold has had the courage for decades to broadcast his real first and last name and to do God knows what over on the Dark Continent for the cause. But I don't even have the courage to tell you that my real name isn't Bob. But what I will tell you is this. It's essential that when you endeavor to racially awaken other white people, that you abstain from using words that have been purposely programmed by our ancient enemies to make them stop listening, or even worse, actively seek to silence you. White people are, unfortunately, incredibly susceptible to ideological propaganda. And if you wish to convert them to a competing brand that's actually in their own self-interest, you will first have to master the skill of not running afoul of whatever is currently polluting their minds. As a side note, it's no coincidence that the same man that made his Uncle Freud's books popular here in the United States also created the word propaganda and coined the phrase public relations. The ethnicity of Edward Bernays should also come as no surprise. Needless to say, he wasn't a nigger. It's also imperative to your own security that you not draw words from the poisoned well provided to you by our malevolent lords and masters. You can be sure that if, God forbid, you one day find yourself in some kind of physical altercation with an African American, that your prosecutor will do everything he or she can to send you to prison for a hate crime if your previously published verbiage is anything approaching politically incorrect speech. My suggestion is simply this: be creative. We have a hard and long fight ahead of us and behind us. If you find yourself arguing with some fundamentalist Zionist Christian, do not even try and tell them that the many reasons why they shouldn't support Israel. Instead, tell them why Israel is the best country on earth because they have strict race-based immigration, marriage, employment, voting, and residence laws and make no apologies for being a country of, by, and for Jews only. And then sit back and watch with amusement as they try to reconcile their mutually exclusive anti-racist and pro-Israel programming. Let's be honest. Israel sounds like a really nice kind of country for one's own people to have, doesn't it? Likewise, if you find yourself arguing with some Afrocentric American, just be their friend. Tell them about how great it will be for them to escape white privilege and oppression by having their own country with all black policemen and all black judges, juries, congressmen, and of course, presidents. Nationalism is an equal opportunity employer. It always benefits the racial majority of its constituents. And it's working just fine right now for Israel, and it's worked even better for us in the past. Let's all get there together, shall we?
I remember many years ago when the late J.B. Stoner was running for Congress or governor or something in Georgia, and he was about to get his 5 free minutes of live air time on some local TV station in Atlanta. And the station manager said to him, "Now, Mr. Stoner, our policy is to give this 5 free minutes of live air time to all candidates. But we've heard about you in the National States Rights Party, and there is this one word that we don't want you to use because it's very rude and offensive to our viewers, many of whom are of the African-American persuasion." And JB asks, "Well, what word's that?" And the station manager says, "Well, you know, it begins with an N." And JB says, "Oh, yeah, oh, okay, I got you. Wouldn't want to offend any of our African-American fellow citizens, now would we? Fine, I won't say that word." So when his 5-minute live spot came up during the candidates' debate or whatever it was, JB stood there behind the podium in front of the TV cameras, and the MC introduced him, and the cameraman gave him the signal to start speaking. And JB looked right into the camera lens, and he said, "Nigger, nigger, 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 nigger." Now, of course, a lot of people then and now thought he was just being a dumb old redneck, but I've always understood what Mr. Stoner meant by doing that. And I frankly think it's one of the most morally profound things any of us have ever done. What JB Stoner was saying to the system, to the people with power to control his access to TV and the political process, and eventually who sent him to prison because they could not silence him, what he was saying to them and to us was that he would not allow them to set the parameters of acceptable discussion or language or thought. That's what our lords and masters demand. They want the right to decide the parameters. They want to decide what's in bounds and what's out of bounds. They want to decide what may be said and what may not be said because they know that's the key to their power over the lives of others. Okay, here comes the spaced repetition bit. I've said all this before on previous podcasts, but now I'll go over it again. The first thing I want all of you to do is I want you to go out, then I want you to obtain a copy, if you don't have one already, of George Orwell's novel, 1984. Now, if you have not read 1984, you need to drop everything and read it. And I don't care if it's in a long block of text and it doesn't have any pictures. I know it's hard for a lot of Americans today, especially young white people, to read a block of text for content, but you need to do this. You need to get that book and you need to read it. In fact, you need to read that one even before you read my own Northwest novels, because 1984, more than any other single work, explains the nature of the society that we live in. Not exactly. When Orwell was writing in 1948, he was thinking in terms of a Stalinist tyranny of the type that existed in Russia at the time. And we have developed in this country a much smoother article down through the decades, but still, the basic principles are the same. Orwell defined the world that we live in today. He predicted it. He was a genuine prophet and he saw it coming. And he described it in terms and in concepts which are still applicable. Before you even read the novel, as good as that is, I want you to go to the glossary where it talks about newspeak, the control of language in order to facilitate the control of ideas. I want you to read that section before you even read the rest of the book, because it will help you understand what's going on in the novel, and it will also help you understand what's going on in the world we live today. Now, the reason that certain words are becoming forbidden, nigger, faggot, kike, etc., etc., is not because the system or the people in power are concerned about offending anyone. If they were concerned about who they offended, they wouldn't be where they are and doing what they're doing. No, the reason that they're trying to make certain words forbidden is because they don't want us to have the very language with which to express certain kinds of dissent. What they're trying to do is not control our words or control our speech. They're trying to control our thoughts. By making it a punishable offense to say nigger or faggot, or I guess other words will be added soon, kike or whatever, beaner, by making those words themselves punishable through loss of employment, defunctionalization, in some countries in Europe through arrest and imprisonment, what the system is trying to do is induce a form of thought control. They're trying to make people so afraid that they will let such a word slip that they monitor their own thoughts in a kind of an ongoing process. They scan each sentence in their minds before they speak, looking not only for the forbidden N-word, but looking for any kind of unorthodoxy. White people in Western societies these days are afraid. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed how, before anyone makes any reference to race or illegal immigration or Israel or any kind of forbidden topic, they quietly will look around and look over their shoulder to see who's listening in the break room or in a bar or wherever you are? That's because one of the first attributes of a police state now applies in America: the constant fear of informers. White people are afraid to say what they mean because they're afraid that some little busybody will turn them in to the police, to the FBI, to the media, but most especially to their employer. That's how dissent is punished in America today, through loss of employment. Western Europe and other countries, Canada and so forth, have these hate laws that expressly ban any criticism of the government's racial policy, any criticism of minorities, etc., etc. Here in America, we, technically speaking, still have the First Amendment. We have a right to freedom of speech and freedom of thought and all that sort of stuff, but what we don't have is a right to continue employed afterwards. It's kind of like the old joke. The American and the Russian are talking about free speech, and the American says, well, we have free speech in America, and the Russian says, ah, well, we have free speech in the Soviet Union as well. And the American says, ah, yes, but in America, we have freedom after the speech. Well, that's no longer true. Anyway, getting back to what I'm saying, the purpose of banning certain words is to try and ban certain thoughts. We, as a resistance movement, have to resist not only other acts of tyranny on the part of our rulers, but the tyranny of the mind as well. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not saying stand up in your break room and yell nigger, nigger, nigger like J.B. Stoner. I am not advocating that anyone do anything stupid that's going to get them fired or going to get them involved in some kind of entanglement with the law. Believe it or not, I do have a fairly practical attitude towards all this. But if we are going to be a revolutionary vanguard for the white race, and if we are going to establish a sovereign independent nation here in the Pacific Northwest, we are going to have to take a position of leadership for our community and for our people. And that's not just political leadership or economic leadership or anything like that. It is also moral leadership. I'll tell you something else. When I listen to Bob's audio tape, I'm running into this idea that we are in some way out to convert the masses. No, we're not, because that's not going to happen. Let me be very blunt here in case I haven't been so in the past. The masses are gone. What I'm after on this podcast, what the Northwest Front is after, is that tiny minority of people who are still capable of acting, that tiny minority of people who still have the old alpha gene, that tiny number of people who can go first. I use the general ballpark figure of 1,000 people. We're looking for 1,000 Class A white people, the ones who still have the alpha gene, the ones who can still go first. One of the indications that a person is like that will be that they are unafraid to use the N-word. They're unafraid to say nigger. I'm running a bit long here, so I'll try to sum this up. If we're going to be leaders in the racial struggle for the 14 words, there's two words that we're going to have to be unafraid to say, and we're going to have to be unafraid to let our own people hear us saying it. Those two words are nigger and white. We must not only show that we will not allow the system to control our thoughts and our language and our behavior, but we must also demonstrate that we are not afraid to talk about our own people, our own heritage. Not to say that we're against Obama or we're against taxes or this whole Tea Party thing. We need to be able to stand up and say, we want to save the white race. Commander Rockwell said that the difference between a conservative and a national socialist is a national socialist is concerned about his race. Conservative is only concerned about his money. We have to be able to stand up in front of our own people and let them know that we are concerned about our race. And that involves using those two words. Use them with discretion, but use them, nigger and white, because that is how our own people will know that we're telling the truth. This is an old march called Preussen's Gloria, Prussia's Glory. I have played this before in another version, but one of our listeners sent me this version and asked specifically that I play it on the show, so by request. Normally, our program is dated on the Thursday it comes out, but in this case, there's a reason for the podcast being dated November the 9th, which is in fact a Wednesday. November the 9th is Martyrs' Day, on which our movement commemorates the many people who have given up their lives for the 14 words, not the least David Lane himself. This festival has its roots in the fact that November the 9th is the anniversary of one of the most significant events in the National Socialist Revolution in Germany. The so-called Beer Hall Putsch, and of the deaths of 16 heroes who, with the Fuhrer Adolf Hitler, marched that day from the Bürgerbräu Keller to the Feldherrenhall in Munich, where they were gunned down when the Weimar police opened fire on the unarmed marchers. They came from all walks of life, but had in common a burning desire to restore the honor of the fatherland, the spark of conscience and historical responsibility, and the knowledge that, no matter how distant or unattainable the goal seems, the evil men do can also be undone by men. I've always felt that this would be a good date to use for a general commemoration of all our martyrs, including men like David Lane and Bob Matthews, whom I corresponded with, John Coey and Richard Biederman and Jeff Hughes, whom I knew personally, Joe Rowan, Gordon Call, and the Weaver family, whom I never met, and all the untold numbers of other unknown and unsung people who have died over the past 70 years because they were white and because they fought to make a better world. But behind all of these will be the 16 martyrs of Munich, the first white men to give their lives in a conscious attempt to create an Aryan ethno-state for all of our folk and a true new order in the world. The white man has countless heroes and martyrs down through the centuries, of course, but these 16 men were the first of their kind. Heroes who struggled and fought and died in the overt consciousness of their racial identity and the racial goal that they sought. Pastor Robert Miles once said that a racist is someone who knows who he is. These 16 men of Germany in 1923 knew who they were. Their names will never be forgotten. Felix Alfarth, Andreas Bareidel, Theodor Casella, Wilhelm Ehrlich, Martin Faust, Anton Heckenberger, Oskar Kuhner, Karl Kuhn, Karl LaForce, Kurt Neubauer, Klaus von Papa, Theodor Forten, Johann Rickmers, Max Erwin von Schubnerichter, Lorenz Ritter von Stransky, Wilhelm Wolf, und ihr habt doch gesiegt, Kameraden. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha on the Bon. Freedom. Freedom.